I had originally thought that I would talk about my book, which is still fairly recent here, but I don't have anything left to publish from it as a separate paper. And since I'll be publishing something else in the eventual book that they're hoping to do here, it was Jan's suggestion that I give that paper here and benefit from your comments. So I think what I say here will be consonant with the larger view that I have, and some parts of it will show up here a little bit, just sketched without really being defended. But I suppose some people would say that same thing about the book. The title, it's important to point out, is not the one that's on the program, which says, Democracy Counts, Why Rulers Should Be Numerous. Importantly, the real title is, Democracy Counts, Should Rulers Be Numerous? ? So one of my main points is that it's in certain ways not as obvious as it might seem that they must be numerous. So my aims in this paper are really pretty modest and exploratory. First, I want to point out the uncertain connection between the idea of democracy and the idea of numerous rulers. So even assuming that we have a strong case, a moral case for democracy, and I'll just very roughly sketch one possible case, this won't settle whether the number of lawmakers should be numerous. And I'll try to make that point seem both surprising and persuasive. And then secondly, I'll consider just a few considerations that might militate for or against a more numerous representative assembly. And one kind of reason for larger assemblies that I'll look at is going to be the idea of collective wisdom. And my goal in that second part is not at all to try to settle the question of the optimal size of assemblies, but just to make some points about how these shrinking and expanding factors interact. And in particular, there are some interesting puzzles, I think, about collective wisdom in that context. It's arguably, just to look ahead a little bit, is arguably an expanding factor, but as you'll see, it might actually support a certain kind of serious shrinkage, or maybe a kind of shrinkage and then expansion back out again, so we'll get to that. So I want to sketch, and as I say, not really argue for, one possible case for democracy, and the point of this is just to illustrate some distinctions that throw the question of numbers into some doubt. And I start with an approach to political justification that has roots going back arguably to Hobbes, but it's really especially influential today, I think, under the influence of Rawls. And it's the idea that political coercion and authority require justification that's acceptable to all of the subjects, then with an important proviso, at least if they're not beyond the pale in certain ways, or as long as they're not unreasonable, or something along those lines. So I sometimes refer to this as the general acceptability requirement. When I originally wrote this paper, I called it liberal republicanism, but that name's not going to help you remember the idea very much. The general acceptability requirement is the more evocative idea. So the idea is that justifications have to take place in terms acceptable to all points of view, excepting some special class of points of view, which would just be called, as a term of art, the unreasonable ones. So that's a schema for a family of views, and it can be specified in lots of different ways, but that's enough for my purposes, because the point I want to make, the twofold point I want to make about that idea, is that it already recognizes in a certain way the equality of persons. No one matters less than anyone else in this certain way. Everybody is entitled to a justification they can accept as long as they're reasonable. So it recognizes the equality of persons politically in a certain way, and yet, secondly, it doesn't directly entail anything about democracy. Some people have called this a kind of democratic principle. I just deny it. And the reason is it says nothing about who may rule. It just doesn't address that question. It puts some framework around how you would justify who's going to rule, but it's not a democratic principle, I think. It's a certain kind of liberal principle, and that's what Rawls calls it. Now, by the sovereign body, I'm going to use vocabulary in some sort of idiosyncratic ways, but hopefully you can just sort of accept my usage for today. By the sovereign body, I'm going to mean the set of individuals whose actual acts of authorization are required for legitimate law, not some hypothetical contractualist sort of thing. So by being in the set of people who are owed these justifications that you can in principle accept, that doesn't make you a member of the sovereign yet, because it doesn't yet say that your will is necessary for authorization. And recall that this view I call liberal republicanism is the requirement that justification be acceptable to every reasonable citizen. And it's important to note that liberal republicanism, or this general acceptability requirement, doesn't logically imply, first of all, popular sovereignty. Now, by popular sovereignty, I'll mean that no one has a greater share of sovereignty, that is the role of one's will in authorizing laws and policies, than anyone else. And to be a member of the sovereign, is to be among those whose actual wills equally authorize law and policy. The set of citizens, as I'll use that term, will be understood just as the people to whom those justifications are owed. And they may or may not, in principle, they may or may not all be among the legitimate members of the sovereign body. These are two different ideas. One, the people who are owed these justifications. Two, the sovereign, the set of people whose actual wills are required for authorizing the law. And conceptually, these are separate things. So you can see in principle that a justification, there might be some justification in principle that's acceptable to all reasonable points of view, showing that only some single person or some small group of people ought to have the ultimate power of sovereignty. And that point, it's in the end, I don't think that point will go through, but that's an open possibility conceptually. And that point isn't blocked by the importance, which I'm just going to assume here, of having enforceable constitutional limits on the sovereign, whoever it is. So Locke, for example, takes that step beyond Hobbes, says there should be these limits in a certain way on the sovereign. But that step by itself doesn't apply any pressure at all in the direction of popular sovereignty. It's a completely separate question. You could have a single sovereign still, for all we know, but should be limited in certain ways, as Locke showed or argued, that unlimited sovereign would be arguably worse than the state of nature and so on. It says nothing about how popular the sovereign should be in that sense. So it's a substantive moral question that's not settled by the concepts whether only popular sovereignty could be justifiable to every reasonable point of view. So I think the case for democracy, I'll connect the ideas of popular sovereignty and democracy in a second, but let me just say I think the case for democracy is going to depend on whether the claim that some smaller group, some individual or elite group, for example, would rule better than popular sovereignty, whether that claim can be made beyond reasonable objection. That's how I think the case for democracy has to go. It's not settled by the moral principle of general acceptability. I won't go into this here, but elsewhere I argue, and I'll just assume here, that no such claim can pass muster, that no argument for some smaller elite group, what I'll call the knowers or epistocrats, can meet that general acceptability requirement. We do have, I take seriously epistemic imperatives in politics, and then this general acceptability requirement sort of comes in and blocks certain kinds of epistemic devices because they're not generally acceptable. I'll come back to that. So the next important point is that popular sovereignty doesn't entail democracy. I'm going to use these terms. The reason is that I'll come to the definition of representation in a second, but the reason that popular sovereignty doesn't entail democracy is that popular sovereignty, making everybody equally a member of the sovereign, would seem to allow each individual, if they wanted, to autonomously alienate their sovereignty irrevocably. That, so far, is left open by the idea of popular sovereignty. So that wouldn't reduce the idea of popular sovereignty just to nothing, because if somebody claimed that they had been irrevocably given sovereignty by the originally popular sovereign, that claim could always be questioned. The principle of popular sovereignty would ask, when did that happen? How did that happen? And so on. So that's not, it's not nothing, but it's not democracy. I think the idea of democracy is better understood as a stronger principle, and that's that no individual's share of sovereignty can be irrevocably alienated. So democracy means inalienable popular sovereignty. Now, delegating or authorizing representatives, I think, is not an irrevocable alienation of sovereignty. It's a temporary and very provisional and constrained kind of delegation of something like sovereignty. And so it's not contrary to democracy. And I think this is the way we want the terms to come out. The substantive questions aren't really about whether representative democracy is an oxymoron. That would be a silly thing to hold in this day and age. The substantive questions are about whether representation in certain uses is legitimate or advisable. And it, as I understand these concepts, it's compatible in principle with the principle of democracy. So if sovereignty is inalienable, that is, it can't be irrevocably alienated, this allows for representation in certain temporary and revocable ways, then the members of the sovereign are also, in a certain sense, the ultimate rulers. So, and if sovereignty is also popular, spread out among everyone, then every citizen is equally and inalienable and inalienably a ruler or a member of the ruling body. It's their actual wills that authorize law and policy. So let me turn to the idea of representation, which I use again in a somewhat idiosyncratic way. Suppose we accept this idea of liberal republican citizenship being owed justifications that everyone can accept, so long as they're not unreasonable in certain ways. And also, suppose we have some grounds for moving from that to popular but limited and inalienable sovereignty. We're not arguing for all these things here, but looking toward what would and wouldn't follow from them. So suppose we've gotten to that, popular sovereignty, limited and inalienable. Now, the choices faced by the collection of citizens in their actions divide, I think, broadly into two categories we might call election and policy. So election would be where the sovereign authorizes a person or body to make choices on its behalf. And we can distinguish appointments, another idea, from elections, so that an appointment would be the authorization of a person or body, not directly by the sovereign, but by someone authorized by the sovereign. So with election, appointment, which is just this iterated authorization. Election and appointment, yeah. And then in the policy, let policy mean all the collective decisions that are not elections or appointments.
Example of appointment?
Supreme Court or legislatures appoint an agency, things like that. So once popular sovereignty is accepted, there's no avoiding representation in some form in the way I use representation. So even Athenian democracy, as I understand it, couldn't entirely govern through the General Assembly. There's just too much work to do, and lots of this work, including important decision-making, had to be delegated. This counts as representation in my sense. These people are authorized to make decisions by people who hold sovereignty. So if the question were to arise whether representatives, which I am going to argue are unavoidable, count as rulers, if somebody says, are those the rulers, there's no reason to deny it. In a certain sense, they're rulers, not only because they're also citizens, but also because they rule in a stronger sense than the original citizens. They're given extra powers, which are delegated to them and taken away from the citizens. But still, we want to distinguish between authorized rulers, like representatives, and what we might call ultimate rulers, the people who hold sovereignty such that they can authorize rulers. So let me turn now to the question of numbers that arise among representative groups or assemblies or bodies. So we can grant inalienable popular sovereignty, constitutional limits on its authority, and even grant that pure direct democracy without any representatives is wildly infeasible. None of this lends any support to the idea that the representative body must have more than one member. Could be a single authorized, legally limited representative legislator. So nothing about the idea of representation, as I've understood it here, authorized or delegated rule, provides the rationale for large numbers of legislators rather than a single individual or a small ruling body. Now, in an important sense, you could, sort of puzzlingly call that case representative democracy. You've got a democratic regime in the sense that sovereignty is held popularly and so on, and it's representative because there is this one representative. But the idea of representative democracy connotes large numbers, and so I won't call that representative democracy. Let's have a special name for it. Call it regency, where that would be a single delegated representative or, say, a very small panel. It might seem that this idea is precluded by the logistical problems of time and resources that counted against a pure direct democracy, because no individual could do all that needs to be done by a legislature. But notice that even when you have numerous elected representatives, they're expected to, in one way or another, pay attention to all proposed legislation and so on, and this is more than they can do without delegated staffs and assistants and so on, agencies and so on. But these devices could be used, appointed and used by a single representative, too. So my point isn't to recommend the institution of a regent or a regency, but to ask what, if anything, is wrong with it from the standpoint of democracy. It's representative, democratically authorized, no alienation of sovereignty, and assume it's constitutionally limited. You could say, well, citizens don't vote for the laws in that case. You have this regent making the laws. But they don't vote for the laws if the legislature has 500 members in a society of 200 million citizens either. So that wouldn't be an objection. So I think it's an interesting challenge for normative democratic theory to explain what, if anything, would be wrong with a single member legislature. So now what I want to do in the rest of the talk is look at just a couple factors that might be thought to press toward larger numbers and several that might be thought to push toward smaller numbers and look at how they interact. Before looking at particular factors, it'll help to lay out just a simplified picture of how we might consider the question. And the primary simplifying device that I'm going to use is to imagine just three sizes, what I'll call regency, representative assembly, and referendum. So this yields two different places where an expanding or shrinking factor might apply, what I call the low range and the high range. We can leave the numbers involved fairly vague that would define these factors, but let's assume something like the referendum size is in the millions. The representative assembly size is, say, between, say, 100 and a few thousand or something like that. As Jan points out, they're typically smaller than that, usually not up to 1,000. And this graphic sort of summarizes those ideas. Now, some factors that I'm going to look at will count against rule by regents and toward larger numbers, moving from left to right. And other factors will count against referendum, pushing towards smaller numbers from right to left. Now, it might seem that these are going to balance out in some way in favor of rule by middle numbers, representative assembly, but I think a closer look at these factors makes that far from obvious. And also just think in general, it's by no means the case that when you have countervailing factors like this, that they balance out in the middle. Sometimes the stronger one just pushes all the way to the finish line, right? So you might have an expanding factor and a shrinking factor. The expanding factor just wins all the way. So it's an open question whether the factors that we'll consider, that's really the interest I have, are the factors that push in one direction sufficient in context to just push all the way to the somewhat implausible extreme in either end. So consider a list of a few considerations that might be offered in favor of larger numbers. I'll call these expanding factors. Go through these fairly quickly. One idea that might argue for expansion is that apart from any tendency to produce good deliberations or outcomes, each person is owed a hearing, and so you want as many people as possible to have their point of view presented. A second idea might be that each person's interests should be entered into deliberation, which is a different idea if voters are to make an informed decision. So the interests might be entered in a different way than by giving each person a voice. A third expanding factor is the Condorcet jury theorem kind of consideration. All other things being equal, it might be that if voters are better than random and independent in certain ways, that majority vote will make correct decisions more often if they're more numerous. And then collective wisdom, which is a different idea as I understand it, other things being equal and under certain free conditions, the inclusion of more voices tend to promote substantively better decisions. This is different, crucially different from the Condorcet jury theorem. This is often not noticed, although I doubt this mistake is made by anyone here. But the Condorcet jury theorem makes no use of discussion. And in fact, it faces risks of the violation of independence when discussion takes place. Sometimes people vaguely speak of the jury theorem as a kind of bringing together of perspectives, but that would commit them to the idea that coin flips bring together perspectives. Right? It has nothing to do with sharing perspectives at all. It's compatible, for example, the discussion idea of bringing together perspectives doesn't require the majority rule aspect of the Condorcet jury theorem. It's compatible in principle with choosing a random voter after discussion and benefiting from the epistemic action that way. There's an interesting DPhil thesis that Ben Saunders is just finishing at Oxford, where the whole thesis explores the merits of that method, where you have discussion and so on, and then pick a random voter and let them rule. And it has certain advantages, but I'm not saying on balance that it's best. So three of these four considerations suggest that larger numbers are supported by the higher quality that this would lend to the outcomes. The fair deliberation one doesn't base it on that. Waldron puts forward a fair deliberation consideration in favor of larger numbers, and I'll briefly mention a problem with that. I think it's hard to think of expanding factors that don't rely on considerations of the quality of decisions, and that's one of the points I want to make. The familiar idea of simple procedural fairness makes no reference to the quality of deliberations or outcomes at all. It's true, but the simple idea of procedural fairness has no tendency to support large numbers at all. There's no reason a regency couldn't be procedurally fair to all members. You could pick the regent randomly. That's fair to all members. Or, in fact, skip the regent and just pick the policy randomly. That's fair to all members. I think procedural fairness is an extremely thin idea. My point here is just that it has no tendency to push toward larger numbers. Waldron's idea is a little different. He says not simple procedural fairness, but another kind of fairness to views, or a fair say. And I'm going to put that aside. I don't think that is an appeal to procedural fairness, because that's one kind of fairness. Picking a policy randomly is another kind of fairness. Fairness doesn't decide between those two things. Something else is making him prefer the fairness to views. Elsewhere, I argue, it's probably some epistemic consideration that is, let's say, hidden. So I reject that as an expanding factor. I think there are quality grounds that you might consider for expanding in the direction of from the regency toward the assembly, and the question is whether they push all the way up to referendum. Now, the idea of a regency, so take the idea of coverage, the idea of a regency naturally prompts the idea that only a small subset of relevant points of view is given any political influence. But why doesn't that consideration push all the way up to referendum? I myself think it's implausible to think there are fewer relevant points of view than people, or significantly fewer. So I'm just going to go very quickly over that, but I'm not sure why that would run out at the assembly level. There may be other considerations pushing back, but that thing doesn't stop. That consideration doesn't stop, I think, at the assembly level. The jury theorem consideration, I think, similarly pushes all the way up to referendum. The benefits of the Condorcet jury theorem, such as they are, don't run out at medium-sized numbers. They go all the way up. Collective wisdom consideration, for reasons similar to the point I made about representation of interests, and there being arguably as many interest points of view as people. Again, I don't think there's any reason to think there are fewer relevant, reason points of view, reasons that could be entered in a deliberative way to make good points and so on. I don't see any reason to think that's a smaller set than the number of people. So again, I don't see that why that consideration would run out at the size of the assembly. So if you thought there were 100 million citizens but only 1,000 relevant reason perspectives, then it stops at the assembly, but I just think that's implausible. Let's turn to shrinking factors. I'm going to argue that most of these actually don't turn out to be shrinking factors. I'll go, again, quite quickly through them. There's the pragmatic consideration, which I think is a shrinking factor, and that's that pure direct democracy, where everything is settled by referendum, is wildly infeasible, as I said before. That doesn't mean, though, that many things couldn't be settled, or some things could be settled by referendum. The set of citizens has enough time to do some things by referendum, and so what would be the maximal amount of that? So it's a shrinking factor in a certain way, but it doesn't assume that all decisions must be made by some smaller set. The idea of preeminence would be the idea that some few are significantly wiser and that would push back in a smaller direction. Some argue on empirical grounds that election tends to choose social superiors, for example. One little point I want to make about this is that if you think, this is a sort of slightly different but related idea, so if you think that large numbers of people for Condorcetian reasons or whatever reasons can pick especially good representatives in a way that makes things epistemically better, shrinks the size of decision makers, but makes them enough better that outweighs the loss of numbers, there's a puzzle, which is, why wouldn't that happen at the next iteration? So I call that the problem of the shrinking assembly. I mean, it depends on where the number is set, but it just seems to bear some thought. If you think, you know, millions of people could pick a few hundred that would be enough better that the small numbers would be outweighed, why can't a few hundred pick 10 that would be enough better that would, and why, you know, and where would that run out and why would it run out? Another idea is professionalism, and in fact, I'm just going to skip over that for interests of time. And then pathologies of deliberation, and that'd be the idea that if the numbers are too large, the epistemic value of the procedure gets ruined in some way. And I'm not going to look at specific pathologies, but just step back from the specifics and suppose that there are problems like that, that if the numbers are too big, the epistemic value is damaged or destroyed. Small point I want to make about that, if that's right and you use that to shrink in the direction of the assembly, you face a problem about why representatives should be elected. Because those pathologies are going to apply to the many millions of voters that would elect representatives. Right? So if you use that as a way of shrinking the assembly, you also have to ask, why should we pick assemblies by elections? The pathologies would apply with those large numbers in the first place. A quick thought about whether the pathologies of large numbers, and there's different kinds of pathologies of large numbers, could be removed by what we might call districting. So this is in the paper, but I'll consider it very quickly. Can we district people in such a way that we keep them in smaller, less pathological groups, and then have them elect representatives, and that representatives will then meet in what's a smaller group than otherwise would be, and so a less pathological group. And just a little point about that, it's not clear that we can do that in sort of large modern democracies, depending on the size, of course, of the overall electorate. The danger is that either the districts are too large internally to avoid the pathologies, or if you shrink them, you just get more districts. And the numbers of electors are large enough in the millions that arguably you're going to either have very large districts, in which case you may face these pathologies, or it's just so many districts that you have so many representatives that you face the pathologies there. So the challenge here is that either the districts will be too large or too numerous. There are possibilities of what we might call nested districting. So you district, pick representatives, let them district again and pick representatives, and I say a few things about that in the paper. So let me just sum up with some very tentative conclusions. So I'll just read through these. So the liberal logic of what I call individualized justification, or general acceptability, or liberal republicanism, doesn't directly entail popular sovereignty. It says nothing about who rules. That would take further argument. Popular sovereignty itself isn't quite democracy, unless it's inalienable, which is an extra principle. Suppose we got to democracy through some set of arguments. Democracy must, I think, in practice, involve delegation to a subset of representatives. But there's nothing undemocratic if the number of representatives is very small as one. We've got democracy. They have to delegate representatives. Nothing about the idea of democracy says how many they have to delegate. So therefore, democratic citizens face complex choices about how numerous the authorized rulers should be, and it's just not settled by the ideas or values of democracy itself, but by other considerations. Pure direct democracy, sort of everything settled by referendum, is, and I think always has been, out of the question. So that's at one extreme. On the other extreme, regency, this sort of elected very tiny assembly, one or a few people, isn't just obviously out of the question, at least prior to consideration I think, mainly about the substantive quality of the decisions. So I think regency is an option open to democratic theory morally, and the only way to push it up, push the numbers up, is by considering the substantive quality of the decisions that larger numbers would make. And then you have to face this question of why doesn't it push all the way up to referendum, as I've mentioned. So I'll stop there.
I have three points to make. The first would be about your very definition of democracy, because in my view, you give a very horizontal definition of democracy, as if democracy was only about making decision, and if the problem was only to making decision by the whole people or making decision by a small group or by a region. But in fact, democracy is not only about making decision. If you follow even the classics like Rousseau, democracy is about building a social will. And a will is not a decision. If you take the example of a referendum, what is the central argument, not against referendum, but discussing referendum, is referendum is about making a precise decision. And if you multiply the referendum, you can multiply decision every day or even every minute. And the problem is that a set of decision doesn't build what could be called a will. And that is the main problem for Rousseau. Generality is not about a decision. Generality is about also a certain type of temporality. You're very right to suggest that in Rousseau's term, the problem of sovereignty is not only about what you call numerosity. It's very important. It's about generality. Right. But in my view, perhaps you don't. You could draw a lot more from his remark, a very important remark, that numerosity is not generality. But all what Rousseau tries to make is to develop his idea of generality. Generality is not only an aggregative generality, but he also gives, let's say, a sensible definition of generality, the production of a civic animus, the production of a consensus. Rousseau also gives what he says in the letters from the mountain, a negative definition of generality. Generality is what cannot be kept by a specific group. And he also gives a kind of political definition of generality. Generality is the historical production of the society itself. So in my view, if you follow this definition of generality in Rousseau's term, you could produce a larger definition of democracy. Your definition, your table is an horizontal table. You go from the regent to the referendum. But if you take the very definition of what is representative democracy, is representative democracy is about not only dealing with this horizontal definition, but also dealing with a reflexive vision of generality. When the term representative democracy appears in political debates in the late 18th century, representative democracy is not representation against democracy, but which kind of representation could produce more democracy. So it's not a zero-sum game between representation and democracy, but finding the ways to develop different meaning of representation that could produce more democracy. That's the very definition of Condorcet. Condorcet doesn't think that you have to choose between referendum and specific patterns of representation. It said that you have to multiply the conception of representation to produce in some way more direct democracy. So that is a third very important point. But it's, in my view, not your central point. Your central point is about, let's say, an epistemic conception of numbers as a kind of democratic quality. But I would suggest that your real contribution is not about a theory of parliament, because if the result of your demonstration is to say that a parliament is better than the regent, the fact is, historically speaking, decided. And what is not decided today is the relation between regents and colleges. What is more and more important in democracies is the we see a multiplication of boards, colleges, commission, trust, and we need a theory of those institutions. And I think the real contribution of your paper is to provide some basis for such a contribution. I would say the real contribution of your paper is a contribution to a theory of democratic collegiality. And that we need very strongly. Because today, as you know, more and more institutions are organized along those lines of colleges, boards, commissions. That is, groups between, let's say, 8 and 30 members with a task of regulation, of surveillance in a number of activities. The first example, after all, was an American example in the late 19th century, that the ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission. And those institutions are more and more numerous and more important, but there is no democratic theory of those institutions. And I think your vision of why number counts really applies to those institutions in terms of quality of deliberation, the quality of representation. You offer a very elements for a very strong base of such a theory of democratic collegiality. That is an historical challenge today. When, of course, in a purely normative term, you could say that it remains important to prove that an assembly is more important than a regent. But let's say that in political terms, it's less important question. And because it has been all the theories of parliaments from Burke to Strathmill more or less stressed all the points you make. If I consider the different, all your shrinking and all your expanding factors are exactly the factor discussed in all the theories of the relation between, let's say, to speak in the vocabulary of the beginning of the 19th century, between numbers and reason. That's exactly the discussion. As an historian, when I read your factors of shrinking and expanding, I wrote some pieces on people like Guizot and so on. I am full in for the discussion. That's exactly the same vocabulary. So that would be my final suggestion, that your very interesting paper could be much more important in the field of collegiality than in the field of simply putting, let's say, a theory of parliaments. Mm. So I would, from as a reader of your paper, think that we need today a theory of collegiality, and there are a lot of elements for building such a theory in your paper, because of course, how large? When you say large number, that's the point. And in fact, the number of assemblies, in practical terms, you could consider all the history of parliamentary assemblies. There is a kind of permanence. In fact, you never had a real discussion about the size of assemblies. If you consider from ancient Greece to modern times, there is, let's say, the same scope. When the discussion between a regent, I would say the proper expression could be a sovereign decision maker, more than a regent, because a sovereign decision maker that when you elected somebody, he can make decision by himself. And there is a contradiction between the notion, if you are elected, you don't need to share your decision with others. And in some way, the fact to be elected makes more difficult to share your decision with others. If you are unelected, the necessity to share decision with others is much more important. That is what is very central, in commission, colleges, and so on, because people are appointed and not elected. And the necessity of numbers comes from this point. If you are elected, you don't need to be numerous. To make decision, not to discuss legislation, that's quite different. But if you want to make decision in a group of non-elected person, so you need those numbers. That are the elements I would suggest you could, in return, discuss.
Thank you very much. A number of interesting points, and I won't be able to address them all here. So it will help just to clarify the structure of my view to point out that I don't agree. We don't have the same reading of Rousseau, if I understand you. But there's certainly many people who take the view of Rousseau that he understands democracy as a way of building, or constructing, forming the general will. Not that it's that important, but I think the text suggests that he sees democracy as justified by and aimed at discovering the general will, something that it can make mistakes about. If it can make mistakes about it, it's not constructing it. Now, the more important thing is that's the way I see my view, and the general will in that view would correspond in one respect to what I call the sort of content of the general acceptability requirement, right? That's a kind of overlap of everybody's reasonable will. And democracy, in my view, has to be justified by its ability to make decisions that land within that general will. So it's structurally similar to Rousseau as I read him. But it is, in that sense, about making decisions, not about forming the general will. Now, that doesn't defend my view as opposed to the one you attribute to Rousseau. It's just clarificatory. I don't really think of democracy as about making decisions, except at least in the delegation of representatives. It's about inalienable popular sovereignty, and so it's in a way about making decisions, but it might just make one or a very few fundamental decisions to set up representative assemblies and sort of periodically make decisions, and lots of other decisions could be made by smaller numbers of people. Very quickly, could history decide whether regents are better than parliaments? It certainly bears on it, but it's not science. It's going to be controversial in some cases. What counted as success, right? So it certainly bears on it, but it's not clear to me that history could just settle this. There'll be cases where we'll just disagree about whether the results of one or the other were good or bad. There'd be lots of cases, of course, though, where there'd be no disagreement about that, and that would be important. You said that you think my points might apply to smaller collective decision-making bodies, and I think that's true to some extent. A tiny point is that I wouldn't apply the idea of democracy to all those cases. It's a small point, but it can become important. It's just useful to sort of have clear meanings for the terms, and I think if you have a collective body that's not about ruling, it's about making other kinds of decisions, I just think we shouldn't call it democratic. But some of these points would still apply. I think that's right. And thanks for your point about the traditional literature on the contrast between numbers and reason. I mean, that's the way I think of it too, but it sounds like there are some texts that frame it in that way that I should look at or look back at. A last pretty small thing. You suggest that a regent should be called a sovereign decision maker. Quick terminological thing, that's not compatible with the way I understand sovereignty, but it's arbitrary to some extent how we use these terms. They're not sovereign if they only get their authority by having it had been delegated to them. Because if that's the case, there was some prior sovereign. Now, I know what you mean by signaling their sovereignty, that once, depending on the powers that are given to them, they can operate more or less autonomously in some cases. You suggest that, interestingly, that if they're elected, they don't need to be numerous. And if they're appointed, they do. I'm not sure why you think so. It's interesting. It also just strikes me that, interestingly, that it just in practice seems to work the other way. The elected bodies are quite numerous, appointed bodies are quite small. But that wouldn't refute
but
your principle.
Between the executive and the legislative. Executive are not numerous.
Oh, I see. You mean this point would apply only if it were a legislature. Okay, good.
The president.
Yeah, I see. Okay, thanks. All right, that's enough. Yeah, thanks.
Yes, I have to be telegraphic. Can you come back to your three circles? I think that if we start from institutions and not from philosophy, you realize that we live, most of us, depends on the constitutional system, in society where all these three circles are existing.
Yeah.
And we don't need to choose among them. We may have a referendum, representative assembly, and appointed small groups making some peculiar decision. So for me, the problem... Regency.
No, that's supposed to be elected.
Well, if they are elected, they exist everywhere, as Pierre was saying, because in France there is one president of the Republic, in the United States, two... And Tony Blair is one person, and he was very powerful.
That wouldn't count as a regency in my sense, unless they had the authority to appoint the legislature or something. I mean, where the lawmaking power is transferred to some very small body, and from then on it's theirs.
So they do not need to be elected, or they need to be elected, this regency.
I'm considering regents as elected.
So that's like what he was saying. Then we have more than that, because we have also what you called at some point appointed.
Yeah.
Group. So we are, in other terms, in what Labbé de Saint-Pierre used to call a polysynody, a plurality of bodies. Yeah,
okay.
It's Greek, it's
okay.
Nothing strange.
Okay.
The interesting question is what these different groups have to do, not...
Yeah.
What is the most important or the number? Because representative assembly are always, as you said, between 100 in the American Senate. And now philosopher may speculate for hours thinking of a Senate of 50 rather than 100. It seems to me a bit futile because they are basically between 100 and 600. So what do we want? And they exist everywhere. And regency exists almost everywhere, at least in a government also. And referendum, in my opinion, should exist. In Italy, we have exactly these three. The other people have to speak, so it's enough.
Okay, thanks. No, I take your point. So first of all, I don't deny at all that there is a role for bodies of all these sizes. But there are some other interesting questions, which is there pressures toward making the legislature tiny? Or are there pressures toward making the legislature huge? Now, this comes to your other point, which says, why ask that question? Because they're just going to be between 100 and 1,000.
Yes.
Yeah, but there will also always be injustice. Is it not any point in asking sort of what would be justice? And so on? If you mean it may not be practically, you know, helpful or whatever, I didn't say that it would be. So, yeah.
Hello. Hi, just a question back to Rousseau, in a way, because it struck me that the structure of your argument very much followed Rousseau's distinction between sovereignty and government, which allows him to say you can have a democratic sovereign and yet still choose among types of government. But he does not end up in the same place that you do. It seems to me he has a different criteria for choosing the type of government, which is not merely epistemic. So that's what I wanted to ask you about. He brings up this notion of usurpation, the danger that one erases or confuses the distinction between sovereign and government. And so an argument against democratic government for him is that the people tend to think of themselves as sovereign at the moments when they're acting as, they should be acting as government. And we might say for us, a regent, someone who, Napoleon had some sort of plebiscitory justification, and yet he seemed to think of himself as sovereign. So it's that confusion that helps to guide our choice between types of government, not an epistemic criterion. So that's just to say, can't you go very far with your argument and yet not be left only with epistemic criteria for deciding what type of government? There might be this other sort of criteria based on the propensity for usurpation.
Yeah. I don't think I quite yet understand the consideration that you're mentioning, where the people might think of themselves as sovereign at the moment where they should be thinking of themselves as government, or that Napoleon might think of himself as sovereign. I mean, so maybe you could just say a tiny bit more about that, but let me just make one point about that. If there are factors that produce that kind of defect, that's largely an epistemic defect, as I understand it. That's a tendency of that method to fail to produce correct decisions. And the way epistemic failures happen in Rousseau is often because people think of themselves in the wrong way. They think of themselves as members of a small group when they should, things like that. So that would fit in that mold of epistemic defects, which is a pretty broad category.
Now, I'd like to comment on whether the Condorcet jury theorem provides an expanding factor. Now, if the standard assumptions of the theorem hold, then, of course, this is true. But let me draw your attention to one particular way to weaken the assumptions. So let's retain the assumption that no matter what assembly we consider, how large, how small, individual competence is above a half. But let's nonetheless introduce some endogeneity in the competence by assuming that competence is a decreasing function of the size of the assembly, maybe for the reasons that were discussed briefly yesterday. So now it turns out that, well, the Condorcet jury theorem still need not necessarily break down, but whether larger assemblies are more reliable than smaller ones depends on the rate of decrease.
That's
and
right.
In fact, one can specify very precise functional forms for the rate of decrease and then figure out whether or not the theorem continues to hold. And basically, if the decrease is just, I mean, the real picture is more complicated, but if the decrease is just of a particular polynomial form, then you can still have a Condorcet jury theorem, whereas if the decrease is an exponential decrease, then the jury theorem breaks down. And so basically the punchline is that once competence is endogenous as a function of the jury size or the assembly size, it becomes an entirely new question, which assembly size is optimal from a Condorcet jury perspective.
Right. That's a good point. I should have mentioned that. I mean, there's a well-known sort of speculation that, if for one reason or another, expanding it reduces the competence. Now, when you bring factors, and that's proof, so I'm not denying that, but then when you bring factors together, there, if you have some epistemic benefits of larger numbers in discussion, that might countervail that. So, but that's just a, again, abstract possibility. Thanks.
Would you mind going back to your slide on the expanding factors where you have collective wisdom? Thank you. Okay, so just to sort of tie today and yesterday and, you know, what we started from and where we are at now, you said just in passing that, of course, no one here confuses the Condorcet effect and the collective wisdom effect, but that's exactly, but in other circles it's the case, but this is the perfect place to really make it clear, and if I may refer to my own paper, this is exactly my contrast between weak collective wisdom, which is what you call collective wisdom, and strong collective wisdom, of which the Condorcet thing is an example. Now I come to my question. I mean, we have these interesting results, and Scott gave us, all the details, or a lot of the details, about the fact that strong collective wisdom, that is the Condorcet-type effects, works with large numbers. And you seem to regard it as obvious, or maybe it's collective wisdom, and I'm not being in the field, I just am ignorant. But why would it be good to have lots of people discuss in a weak collective wisdom framework? It seems completely counterintuitive. I mean, if there are more than six or eight people, it's going to be hell. And so I just don't see that at all. So that's my first question. And very quickly, my second question is, how can we adjudicate this number thing without having the idea of responsibility or accountability? I mean, a large assembly is unaccountable. A small collège, as Pierre was mentioning, board and so on, might be held accountable because it's a small number of people. Maybe there's a head, it's the Warren Court or something like that. But you seem to ignore this idea of accountability entirely, and that seems strange.
let me come back to the accountability. So first, I don't give any sort of big defense of the idea of the epistemic value of discussion in large numbers. Mm-hmm. But this is one possibility, not crazy. We can understand how it goes, and that's that that there would be epistemic gains to having everybody vote over and above having 10% of the people randomly selected vote. Why? Because arguably, there's no way to get all the reasoned perspective in a 10% sample. Now, this is a growing area of research. There are all kinds of possible pathologies that kick in at larger numbers. So that's, modulo those considerations. As for accountability, I don't think I have to deny any of that. So it's just not a consideration that bears on how large. Well, I suppose maybe it does. You said large assemblies are not accountable. I'm not sure what you mean by that. So, I mean, the individual members are accountable if they're elected periodically. But do you mean something else?
Yes, I mean that I'm sort of moving over to what Pierre was saying, which is this idea of these colleges of people who make, decisions, say hiring and promotion committees. That's crucial. It doesn't work in France at all, because we try to have representatives of all fields, subfields, orientations, and so on. As a result, we have unaccountable hiring committees.
So does this help then?
Yeah, I think
that's right. So does this? But am I getting the right point if I just say I think it's very plausible that mechanisms of accountability would have various kinds of value, including epistemic value, but it doesn't necessarily have to come up here because it's not about how big the assembly should be. That is, accountability matters. We need yet some further argument that accountability is affected by the size. Sorry, that's your claim. Okay, I'm not yet sure why that would be the case, but if so, then that certainly, yeah.
Okay, we have three more questions. You have Elaine and Jan and then Gary, so we'll try and get those and then finish up.
Well, thank you first for the presentation. Can you go back to the slide with the three little circles again? I think one of the reasons people are a little worried about accountability might be the choice of the term regency. And I was wondering why you didn't use another one of your terms, like queen for a day, so something like regency for a day or for 5 years. Because it suggests accountability and re-election that ensure true representation.
You think the idea of regency suggests permanence? Or
yeah, it does.
Inalienable.
I really think so. It's very confusing, I think, for...
That's not an element of the dictionary definition, but I
linking becomes major.
Because it's supportive to me, so I want to make sure. But anyway,
So I have a question following on that.
I just want to hear this point first. It's a historical point about the use of the term regency.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what it means.
It means?
When the king has not regnated 13 or 14 years... Where in the previous king dies, then you'll find the regent.
It's a temporary king.
So it's a
temporary king.
Okay. Okay.
Temporary king.
But it's not a redefinition.
Okay.
The regent's not elected.
Right, so that doesn't happen. Okay, anyway, I'll make sure that I'm absolutely clear.
Queen
that
for a day or something like that would be clearer. Yeah. And also because I think it's absolutely true, you could technically have just one person representing everyone else. But then, now that we've been through all this colloquium on collective wisdom, and I'm getting ahead of my own presentation here, but we've shown, following Scott Page, that cognitive diversity matters, multiplicity of perspective matters. Wouldn't that be an expanding factor, right, to have more people? Because... one person, even if you give them all the data, even if they attend deliberation among many people, they are still one perspective on the whole thing. So they're still going to take a very limited view of. So there's no going around the aggregation of multiple views in a way. So that would count against.
That's exactly my point. Okay. So that is nothing in the sort of moral logic of democracy rules out regency. Mm-hmm. Then when you kick in epistemic considerations, there are expanding factors, but we have to be aware of shrinking factors too.
Okay.
And the idea of the value of multiple perspectives can be interpreted either in the Condorcetian, statistical way, or in the communicative sharing of perspectives way. And I think those both have some expanding force. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I have two quick points. One is this shrinking factor that Kristen referred to, the endogenous decrease in competence with larger assemblies. That could come about in two ways. Either you could have all delegates initially equally competent, but because of epistemic free riding that I discussed yesterday, that Adrian discusses today, they would invest less. in getting knowledge. Or they might be unequally competent initially, and then, of course, the larger the assembly, the less competent would the average be. I think Condorcet clearly recognized the second many times. He doesn't actually address Christian's question whether the net result of these two effects would
limit way, the expansion.
Way it would go. But,
yeah.
My second point, I think, is more important because I think it's something that's been missing here. According to Tocqueville, aristocracies are smart, but democracies have the right values because essentially a majority would never knowingly act against its own interest. So it seems to me that what's lacking in your discussion is how the variously sized assemblies would tend or tend not to promote the public good as distinct from arriving at correct ends, means, instrumental beliefs.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have been clear about this, but I suppose somewhat tendentiously, I think making decisions in the public good is a correct decision. So I fold that into correctness and epistemic. Some people think of epistemic as limited to more technical or factual matters, whereas I don't. So when I talk about the expanding force of epistemic considerations, I mean things like tendency to promote the common good. So it's just another, I think it's another language for the very same point.
It is tendentious.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, there's debates about whether these things are properly called correct or true, but it's, yeah.
Not to dispute your foundations and sovereignty, but to dispute the question of larger and smaller, it seems to me you limit your institutional considerations to those of competence and neglect you limit your institutional considerations to competence when both competence and goodwill are crucial considerations in making the choice between along the spectrum. And just let me finish the thought. So in using contemporary terminology, you can cash out goodwill in terms of agency gains and agency losses. And this is a crucial consideration in the size decision. And I think it's another kind of scissors, just like Christian's account of the Condorcet scissors, where as the assembly gets smaller, you have possible agency losses because fewer people are directly involved in the decision. But if you accept... But you also get possible agency gains if you think of Hannah Pitkin's question about whether the representative is supposed to represent wishes or welfare, subjective interests and objective interests. And since part of the idea of having a representative is the agency delegation that I don't want to have to make those bothersome decisions. You make them and I'll check up on you in a broad way. You get agency gains in that way, and having the representative interpret what the objective interest is subject to check.
I didn't follow all that because I'm not sure of the connection between this terminology of agency gains and this other term, goodwill. Let me say one thing.
Trustworthiness. It's roughly the same. Roughly the same concept.
So maybe this helps a little bit. I do build what you might be calling goodwill or proper motivation considerations into the idea of competence because they just are covered. That is, if your motivations aren't right, you won't tend to make decisions in the public interest, which is what I count as correct. But it is important to point out there are these two dimensions of it. There's sort of knowledge and motivation. But together they bring about what I would call competence, tendency to make the right decision.
Just one short follow-up.
Yeah.
But... it's confusing unless you explicitly distinguish the two because when I choose a medical doctor, I want one that has both competence and goodwill because if either is lacking, I'm risking my health.
Right.
Thanks, David. I just want to put on the table a distinction that when studies legislative organizations hits you in the face all the time, which is the distinction between nominal numbers and effective numbers. Mm-hmm. So Madison says, in all legislative assemblies, the greater the number composing them may be, the fewer will be the men who will in fact direct their proceedings. The countenance of the government may become more democratic, but the soul that animates it will be more oligarchic. That's a point, there's sort of an iron law of legislative oligarchy. You can put it more affirmatively as well, the way Machiavelli does, and say a multitude without a head is useless, that you put 600 legislators in a room, they can't accomplish anything. It's just too disorganized. So what they end up doing is appointing leaders, and that is a kind of de facto constraint on the number and therefore on epistemic quality. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has so much influence about what the House of Representatives does that there's a kind of constraint. You can't. It's not going to be that much smarter than Nancy Pelosi is, no matter how many nominal members it has.
Right, so there's two ways that you might get a smaller number of effective members. One is there might just be various dynamics that lead to some people sort of grabbing power or gaining influence through charisma and so on. That's one factor. Then there's another one, which is less sort of damaging to the way I put it, which is the body can, of course, structure itself once it's got its share of sovereignty. So that's compatible. That's just another decision it makes. Of course, then we'd want to look at the epistemic consequences of shrinking numbers and all that. That's true. We could iterate this forever, because you shrink it down to one, then they could appoint 1,000 delegates. You know, I didn't mention this hourglass thing, but that's essentially the point. This can happen. You could have a situation where we could appoint a single regent, and then he could appoint 1,000 representatives. Sovereignty passes through him, but then you could get the epistemic gains of big numbers back. Then they could appoint a regent. So anyway, that's just one brief response. Yeah.
All right. Thank you again. This was really great.
Thanks very much.